Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
There's a fixation on trying to address the power differential. And wouldn't it be great if we got the first X of Y?
Right.
Now, there are a lot of Americans who are kind of impatient with the first X of Y thing because it doesn't matter as much as we thought or hoped or whatever the hell.
Right.
You know, there were some people that thought Barack Obama, President of the United States, means we're not racist anymore. We're post-racial, right. Which, by the way, we're probably more racist now than we were.
It backfired a bit.
People could, you know, people were making the same argument about Hillary. It's like, hey, first woman president. We like show that we would be over it. And then, you know, like I don't think that would have fixed it.
Imagining, it's systemic problems, right?
Imagining that having an elected representative of a certain identity. And by the way, like I'm for people of different backgrounds being in like different seats. I mean, I think it's great. Same. But making that like the criterion that you're using primarily is not great. And
correct.
A lot of Americans can sense that the media in particular has gone overboard with this. And one of the byproducts of this is that it has the potential to divide the country further, where you have, and I'm going to use you as the proxy, you have like reasonable, well-intended white people, men and women, who are generally aligned with the Democratic Party on some things, but feel driven out because there's this implicit, like, we don't care about you and your perspective because you are the powerful in the power differential equation, and all we're going to do is talk to people who are from an historically marginalized group. This week on Forward, did Bernie get a fair shake from the DNC in 2016? Why parents are struggling with the Democratic Party? What it's like being a white guy in 2022 in politics? This week on Forward. And we're back. This week, there was a bit of a Twitter kerfuffle based upon something I said that I thought people already knew and had accepted. So let me rewind for a moment. A guy named Nick Kristof, who works for the New York Times, very prominent writer, is running for the governor of Oregon, where he grew up, where he's from, has a house, etc. So I saw a story about how the insidery Democratic Secretary of State had said he is ineligible to run in the Democratic primary because he's not a resident. And then Nick was like, hey, this is bogus. Like, I am a resident. And my reaction was, typical Democrats don't want the outsider to run and have a chance to compete, so let's ding him. And there was a sense that the Democratic Secretary of State, obviously close to some of the other Democratic officials in the state who are running against Nick Kristof. Again, this is a Democratic primary.
Mm-hmm.
So intra-democratic affair. And I instinctively thought, like, this is political. And so I wrote, hey, no wonder people are losing so much faith, in a Democratic primary. And then my next thought was that the Democratic Party sometimes has some very anti-lowercase d democratic impulses where they kind of, like, be like, no, let's not listen to whatever the people are saying. Let's just do it ourselves, or we know best. And the most prominent example of that in my mind was kneecapping Bernie during the 2016 presidential nomination,
right,
where Hillary Clinton was the favorite, the anointed one, of the DNC. And so my tweet said something along the lines of, the DNC should have let Hillary and Bernie fight it out fair and square. And if they do that, then Bernie probably wins. And then Bernie probably beats Trump. Democratic Party has some anti-democratic impulses sometimes. And that ended up setting off a Twitter, you know, kerfuffle.
The second part of your quote was, do the failings of the Democratic Party have something to do with the rise of Trump? Question mark. Sure. Will they change tax in 2024? Question mark. Probably not.
Probably not. I think most people would. I didn't know any of this was going to be controversial.
You trended on Twitter. I love days like that. Yeah, I wake up. You chose violence. Twitter's going nuts. Andrew Yang's trending on Twitter. Always a good day. Always. Not been a good day. In hindsight, in the moment's kind of tough. Always fun, though.
Again, like, I thought this was objective, documented fact that the DNC kneecapped Bernie at every turn. I mean, Donna Brazile's book came out and said, yeah, that's what went on.
It was documented fact. She had to walk it back, but it seems pretty documented that Hillary had at least a slight advantage at worst here.
I thought the full story was that the DNC was running low on money and the Hillary Clinton campaign gave them like an allowance. And then in return, the DNC was like, yeah, the fix is in.
That is the bigger allegation here.
I mean, that stuff must be backed up.
Seems pretty. I was trying to do some research on this, like see what we got. I'm not an expert. The story's all over the map. It does seem, while Hillary did that, it also appears that the DNC theoretically offered the same type of influence to other candidates as well.
they said, like, hey, Bernie, you give us money too?
Yeah, if anyone else wants to give us money, we would do the same. Anyway, I obviously anyone watching objectively was like, yeah, she's like the
shadow primary.
The shadow primary.
Yeah, so I didn't think this was necessarily... No, okay, so the DNC putting their thumb on the scale for Hillary, to me, uncontroversial. Was it dispositive in the result? Like, you know, if you just had a truly fair, objective process, does Bernie beat Hillary? That's arguable.
That is arguable.
So the fact that I was like, hey, he probably wins, like, you could take issue with that statement, and I'd be like, yeah. Like, and, you know, I do feel like Bernie shocked everyone with a level of energy around his campaign. It felt very organic. Mm-hmm. That was part of the contrast, where Bernie had the people's energy and then Hillary kind of had that corporate energy. So that, if you take issue and be like, hey, Hillary would have won anyway, it's like, okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Bernie beating Trump, I feel like that's very, I'm confident in that estimation. That piece of it doesn't feel terribly controversial to me either. Like, Trump, if you remember going into that 2016 race, people really were not excited about Trump, and a lot of people thought it was inconceivable that he would.
It would have been interesting, because I think he would have been painted even more of a socialist than he is now by Fox News, and I'd be interested to see how that plays out. But I agree that's definitely a strong argument that he would have had a shot.
So it got me thinking about this entire democratic impulse feeling I have around the Democratic Party, where there is like this corporate layer. They represent the establishment, and then there are people who want various things that are on the outside looking in. Mm-hmm. And I think that dynamic will continue to play out in the Democratic Party, in large part because there are very large corporate interests who are right there with the Democratic Party saying, especially, you know, some of their attached media organizations. The fact that this ended up lighting a bit of a firestorm was genuinely surprising to me, but I guess that just shows where I am.
This opens a number of questions, and I want to ask them all. Because who got mad here? Is either burners who are like, yes, Andrew, this is obvious, like, screw you, like, don't try and jump on our train now, you missed this boat. And then folks that were saying, you're wrong, Andrew, or this isn't the case. So start with the burners piece. Tell me about your support. I mean, I have a good sense of it, but tell the world about your support for Bernie Sanders and your relationship there.
I remember in 2016 watching a Bernie rally or speech on TV and saying, yeah, this is right. I don't disagree with anything he's saying. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, I should support him in some way. So I sent in a donation. Mm-hmm. And then when he lost, I then said, okay, I guess I'll vote for Hillary, mm-hmm. Which I did. So I supported Bernie during the primary, and saw that he was mistreated and kneecapped and, right. and the rest of it. And, you know, I wasn't raging in the streets about it. I was like, oh, yeah, here's the DNC, you know, doing their thing. And then it was like, oh, I guess it's Hillary. I guess, you know, like that was my attitude. It was sadness and frustration over Bernie's treatment. But clearly thought Hillary would be a much better president than Trump. So, you know, that's where I went.
But you had said a number of times when you ran for president that Bernie in some ways inspired your run. Am I right in saying, remembering that? And like, but both policy-wise and then movement-wise and the energy around it, and it's one of the reasons, one of many reasons you were exploring a run in 2020. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It was invigorating and uplifting. And I agreed with everything you were saying. So I was like, wow, there are these really big, deep problems that the American people are trying to figure out how to answer.
And so, and most of our policies, like at least I remember being in the room, we were very spiritually aligned with Bernie's intentions.
Well, we just want to make things better for people.
Right.
Like Bernie wants to make things better for people. I want to make things better for people.
Right.
You know, I think people at every part of the political spectrum want to make things better for people. I just talked to a guy who surveyed Democrats and Republicans about what they want. Most of it's the same.
Yeah, agreed.
It's like there's a slight reorganization, but the top five goes something like more jobs, better schools for kids, better access to health care, reduce crime, like in some order. So things aren't going well. Mm-hmm. Our institutions are underperforming. We're 28th in the world and declining at most basic quality of life measurements.
Right.
And the two parties are not genuinely arguing over who can actually deliver better results for people. It's like an ideological struggle.
Right.
It's one reason why I think Bernie does beat Trump is because Bernie seems and is for the people, not corrupt, sincere, would like really have shaken things up in D.C. as president. That's what most people want at this point.
Yeah. He was similar to you. You guys had a lot in common that you were both laser focused on the issues, like did not get caught up in a lot of like the petty spats and things like that. And he never has his whole career. Generally speaking, he's pretty much laser focused on. For him, it was Vermont or various aspects of his platform. I mean, when Bernie, I remember this, like Bernie had a heart attack in the middle of the race. We thought he was, the world thought he was dropping out. I thought we were going to have to. And like, kudos to him, like a freaking warrior. Like, he had a heart attack back on the trail like 3 days later, whoever it was. But I mean, it wasn't just us. The press as well were saying that, you know, one of the biggest beneficiaries here would be Andrew, of course, as we had a lot of similar both principles and audiences and vibes and things like that. Now, in the presidential, you endorsed Biden, and I would say, I think rational human beings at that point were like, this race is over, you were aligning up. But there were plenty of burners online that are probably the same way the Yang Gang would react if Bernie endorsed Biden and we had already lost, right? But that didn't, like, rationality doesn't always play well on Twitter or online or with rabid fan bases. So thoughts on, maybe talk a little bit more about that endorsement process, what went through your mind? Because I think the whole time you were more of a Bernie guy than a Biden guy, you know?
Yeah, no, I was hoping the whole time that Bernie came out for universal basic income or some version.
Yeah.
And I had communicated in various ways, like, look, you guys come out for UBI, I'm there.
I'm coming early, yeah.
Yeah, and Bernie, for whatever reason, was not a fan of universal basic income at that time. Like, logically, would be Bernie, I don't think.
You had said, if any contender down the stretch here comes out for
It was clear as day. I was
and by the way, the Yang Gang will fall in line too, you know?
Yeah, let's do it.
That's what they're for.
Joe wins Michigan, and at that point, the numbers made it such that it would be nearly impossible.
He swept essentially Super Tuesday, right? It was like
okay, this race is effectively over.
Yep.
And so let me line up and try and get Trump out, because that was, to me, the focus.
Right. Which I respect. It's one of the things, and we'll talk about this probably more on the podcast, but one of the things makes you, in my opinion, a person I respect. And it also makes you, frankly, like a less effective traditional politician, in the sense that you know what it means to be a leader in this, like you value leadership and like what a lot of comes with what, and having been in leadership roles, what comes with leadership is frankly the guy or gal who has to make the hard decision no one likes, right? Like the hard decision there is like, yeah, line up behind the guy. If the greater good is, or greater decision where this country needs to go is a line up behind who can beat Donald Trump, this is the decision a leader needs to make and not worry about his own political career, right? And you, to be fair, you didn't call the Biden team and ask for favors. You didn't say, hey, what are you going to give me? You didn't do that. You just did it. And I think a traditional maybe more selfish politician would be like, hey, Joe, what do you got for me? I'm going to make this endorsement. And you did it because you thought it was the right thing to do and what a leader should do.
Yeah, when Joe called me, I said no. So, you know, it was a pretty shitty way to try and get stuff.
That's true. I forgot about that. Yeah, you did.
Well, part of it, too, and this is what I think what you're suggesting is that I'm not a terribly ideological fellow. You know, if you put me in a seat at a particular moment in time, be like, okay, like what's the maximal value to be had? It's like the maximal value at that point was to try and do everything I could to, in my opinion, get Trump out. And if Joe's going to be the nominee, then let me get to work.
Right.
And try and bring people together as quickly as I can. So that's what I did. Right now with the Forward Party, I feel the same way. It's like, what's the most maximally useful thing I can do? And it's try and give people real choices and just face facts that this duopoly is going to ruin us, that there is no massive transformation that's going to emerge from these institutions. Oh, actually, I take it back.
What?
There are negative transformations that can emerge from these institutions. We're not going to see like the wave of positive transformation innovation like that. That's not happening.
I've been writing about this, talking about how basically sticking to principles or like setting your identity around one policy or position is now the norm. And that's how a lot of people are building what I call identity brands, have people identify with that position, identify with that person. But also it's like they're becoming famous, politically speaking, because of this. And it prevents compromise. But it also is somewhat politically effective, right? Because you can build these movements and become a force and be a thorn in someone's side, whatever it is. You've staked out a few like key principles, but generally speaking, to your point, you're not an ideological fellow, is your exact words. You are, you listen to reason. Frankly, you change your mind when new evidence is presented to the contrary. To me, that's good leadership. I think that's what rational human beings do. But literally the press has called you a lightweight because of that, right? Or they've called you, I mean, God knows what, like a lot of things. Does that frustrate you? Have you ever thought like, oh, maybe I should just like dig my heels in because it's going to be better to accomplish a political goal than what may be true to your principles or who you are naturally as a human?
No, I tend not to think in those terms, but I see the pressures that other political figures are under, which is that, like you said, you stake something out and then you just become. So here is what most politicians would have done in my shoes, I think.
Yeah.
Is like you run for president on universal basic income and then you just become the UBI guy.
Yes.
And then you just run around and say, hey, I'm going to stake this out. Now, I happen to believe in universal basic income and that we need to make it happen. I started an organization, Humanity Forward, that's working very hard to try and move us in that direction. I didn't have that much of an interest in saying like, hey, I'm going to be Mr. UBI forever, which by the way, would have, in my opinion, made me pretty well liked.
We got pressure to do that everywhere we went, like for months.
The reason why I didn't naturally want to do it was because I saw the political pressures for it and against it. And I thought, well, Andrew Yang running around saying UBI, UBI, I don't believe really changes that equation in a way that would make it more likely to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, some people might disagree, but this was my read. Mm-hmm. I think we're better served by having professional lobbyists working it and not leading with Andrew Yang, mm-hmm. you know, just saying, look, your constituents love this. Different mm-hmm. people love this. The political incentives are for you to become a symbol. And then we're like, oh, I can like make currency by being the symbol. Then you just become mm-hmm. that symbol. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of figures get stuck in various ways. I'm more of a human being, I suppose. I'd be like, oh, you know, like, let me try and solve the problem. Let me genuinely try and solve the problem. And to me, solving the problem means reforming these institutions. And I'm really pumped to be doing it because the folks who are working on reforming these institutions are noble and principled and well-intended, and they need help. Mm-hmm. So if I can do that, then there's a much higher chance of these original goals actually being achieved. The issue is that people don't want a whole lot of flexibility or adaptation in their political figures. You know, it's like they'll be singing version of the same tune for years and years and years, which I don't hate.
Right.
You know, it's like you appreciate it.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
When you had finished your presidential race in 2020, if I was keeping my same political marketing hat on, and I'm curious if you would agree with this, this is what I would have told you to do. I would have told you to lean into your identity brand 100%. So you lean in, you're still the cash relief, free money guy, you're an outsider and you're tech forward, opposite Donald Trump, Asian man who likes math, right? I would have pressed you, and folks did press you to get a job in the Biden cabinet, ideally in a tech role, right? That's totally on brand. And in a vague role that had low expectations, maybe a new role, maybe head of, like the existing roles were science and technology, but some sort of like chief innovation officer or secretary of the future or something where you could just go around the country and be the free money, forward thinking guy. And then you would have this brand, you'd own this lane. Never would have advised you to run for mayor or anything else until it was like probably president again, right? And you'd probably have the same, probably had Bernie's fate, if you will, like a better run round two, but still been in your lane and not able to broaden out. But I think that influence would be like politically powerful in various ways. I don't know about you. I had that in my ear from a whole bunch of our supporters, at least the more political, traditional ones. Did you get that as well? Or do you have people giving you this type of advice over and over?
I did hear that sometimes.
Yeah. To me, you're too much of an operator to even ever want to be in a lane like that, you know, where you're like, well, the problem's actually the duopoly. It's not the cash relief. There's plenty of people who can do cash relief now. Like, I've solved that like awareness problem, right? And that's the hardest part, where you become this type of politician, and it's very difficult to get out of it. And you lose some stuff and you can get out of it too. You have to blow some things up. You have to take a step back to go too forward, whatever it is, right?
Yeah. I don't really think in those terms. It's just like, hey, how can I add the most value and solve the most, you know, solve the biggest problems I can during the time. So if it was waffling around DC pretending to have impact and be like, I was on that, like it would have sucked. I don't think that would have been genuine. But I did get advice from people who were thinking in terms of like Democratic politics.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I understood it, but I also thought we'd hate it, you know.
Yeah, but I think people would have recognized it as somewhat inauthentic too.
That's the biggest part of it. You have to remain authentic to yourself. We hated the process of looking into the cabinet roles.
Yeah, it was very distasteful and enervating. Like it didn't make me think like, oh, I really want to.
Can't wait for this.
Yeah, just like, oh God, you guys like. And this is a microcosm of why I think people are frustrated in that. Like my glimpse into that process was like, whoa, like it was like you get in there and then all of a sudden it's like Democratic jockeying for positions of this and that, you know, and I'm seeing it with. So this is not a knock, who the hell knows, but like, you know, Marty Walsh, who was the mayor of Boston, became the Secretary of Labor in D.C. And now the word is that he's going to leave to go come back and run for.
Really?
For, you know, for a position in Massachusetts, think governor, I don't know, something.
Right.
But it just really paints a picture that these big deal DC positions are just another seat. like you do it and you're like, oh, now I'm going to do this. Like there's like this game of musical chairs. And then you'll like talk about the impact you had while you were in that seat. Yeah, so that was the vibe I got, and it wasn't a good feeling.
We talked to a lot of these people that were in, let's call it senior roles in the Office of Science and Technology, the Department of Labor, things like this, and they were talking down to you and me, like, and I wrote this paper, I did this white paper, I did this, a lot of white papers, frankly, but like, and I'm like, I never heard of any of this. I don't think the average American would have a clue.
No, or find, I mean, the average American has no idea that the Office of Science and Technology Policy exists.
This isn't helpful at all. So I mentioned two parts of your tweet that were interesting. One was the Bernie piece, which we kind of just outlined, but the other one was criticizing Democrats in the election in general. And I want to ask you this. I know you're going to think this ridiculous, but I really just want your thoughts. I think there's a challenge. There's like this inherent signal sometimes when you criticize a Democratic Party, you're inherently still okay with what Republicans are doing. So a lot of Democrats, when you criticize the party, be like, we've seen what the Republicans are doing. I mean, they're actual racists. Like, how dare you criticize the Democrats when the Republicans are this bad? How do you think we navigate that? Because I struggle with this too. And I'm like, God, the Dems suck. But they're like, well, the Republicans are awful. Why aren't you complaining about that? It's like, I don't know. We've kind of known the Republicans are god awful for a long time. Do I have to keep hammering it? Like, I'm worried about my team. I don't know. I don't know. Not that it's your team per se anymore, but thoughts on how we are able to criticize the Dems without saying we're okay with the far right.
That is the knee-jerk response on both sides. Like, yeah, have you seen the other side? So this is a segue into a couple of articles that you and I were reading and talking about this week, which were these two parents, moms, who criticized school closures in their communities, one in Cleveland, one in Oakland, and then just got attacked as being Trumpists, essentially, I think.
Yeah.
Or people who were anti
science, anti teachers, anti
like high maintenance,
fucking white parents was what this woman said she was accused of being called in the Atlantic.
Yes. So these parents were negatively impacted by school closures, which any parent can tell you it's a bit of a disaster where your kid eventually just gives up on remote schooling because remote schooling is bullshit. The teacher logs on for remote schooling like 15 minutes a week. And if that seems like an exaggeration, if you talk to enough parents, like, you know, that's not unusual. The response from various activists are to just respond very negatively to criticism. Mm-hmm. But the Democratic Party just takes criticism very, very poorly, even when the stated goals of the party aren't being met. Where if you look at who is going to be negatively impacted by school closures, you know who gets it the worst? Children of color who can least afford a year away from school. Working class parents who need to have a place to bring their kids. The most vulnerable get hurt the most. So if you prioritize those people, you'd be like, you know what? School stay open, hell or high water. Mm-hmm. And that was not the priorities. The priorities were the teachers' unions. And so then when you say, hey, this is messed up, then the right response in some ways would be like, oh yeah, like we really need to get on this because, you know, like we actually live to our values, or like our stated priorities. But because politics has become so tribal, criticism gets taken as like an attack from the other team, even if, as these two moms were, they were both like, hey, I'm on this team. Like, I've been a Democrat for a million years. And the data shows that this issue was a bigger deal in the Virginia race than, quote unquote, critical race theory.
Yep.
As a parent with a child in public school whose school was closed for the better part of a year, parents are so angry about this. And a lot of parents that had the ability, you know, one of the moms in these articles eventually, after it sounds like 2 years of struggle, eventually sent a child to private school.
She had to go to charter school,
Or charter school or private school. Felt really bad about it. But the repercussions to these kids of remote schooling or lack of schooling, I mean, it's going to last 4 years, maybe a generation. There's going to be a reckoning around. Like, this is going to be such a signal failure for anyone who's associated with it. And the sooner the Democratic Party realize that there are a lot of parents that feel this way, because this is a political disaster for Dems, particularly if you're in an area that is anywhere close to being tightly contested.
So we talk about a lot of articles, but this one, guys, I cannot encourage you to read it more. It was jarring. The article's called Why I Soured on Democrats. We'll put it in the link of this episode. It starts off with this woman talking about how much of a card-carrying Dem she is. She's like, I register to vote like before you can possibly register. I've lost friends over how much I hate Donald Trump. I go to protests, and not just the Black Lives Matter protests. I've been protesting for decades. Like, I am the stereotypical, like, female Democratic voter. And she's like, I don't know who to vote for because the Democratic Party has betrayed me. And she talks in detail about how difficult it is to have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old have two working parents and get them through remote school. And, like, for me, I don't have kids. And so yet, and I've always been like, kind of you and I joke, like, oh yeah, that's gotta be hell, right? But then when you read about it, like, that is awful. Awful. And the thought to me of be paying fucking taxes, a lot of taxes, you're taking half your income in taxes, and the school just not be open. And so now infuriating. And the only thing they can do is vote. And they're like, I have Trump or the party that's in power not doing anything. I don't know what to do. And this was the quote that stuck with me. I'm going to read it to you. She said, none of this has shaken my support for the Democratic agenda, which I still endorse wholesale, which is interesting. What I've lost is my trust that the party is truly motivated to act in the interests of those they claim to serve. How can I get excited about universal pre-K proposals, for example, when K through 12 is in shambles? And that, to me, just hit it, the nail on the head right there. Like, I'm still fucking, like the policies of the Democratic Party, yes, let's go. But the Democratic Party didn't do any of it. And so then you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Like, Trump sucks, and the Democrats are supposed to help us also suck. So forward party it is.
This is the fundamental challenge that the Democratic Party will not reckon with, which is that a lot of the institutions aren't actually delivering the value that they're purported to. And it's clearer now with schools during the era of COVID, but it was true of the schools pre-COVID, where if you look at the value that parents and families were getting out of the investments in education, it wasn't what you'd expect or deserve. You know, we've been failing parents right and left for a long time. Mm-hmm. And this is one reason why the duopoly is so toxic, is because the Democrats say, look, we're going to say we're for a bunch of things. And whether or not our schools or hospitals or government or services actually deliver the values we say, irrelevant. The Republican Party will come along and say, hey, we don't believe in a lot of this stuff or these institutions. It's wasteful. It's inefficient. Let's cut. Let's cut taxes, et cetera. And there needs to be a third way where it's, look, we want to use your tax dollars efficiently to deliver resources at a very high value, make it effective, efficient. These schools are going to be great. Your healthcare is going to be great. Your roads are going to be great. Like, we're going to actually kick ass. And right now there's no competitive pressure for government to deliver. You either have these kind of slumping bureaucracies that everyone's getting fed up with, and then Democrats will make lofty promises about what those bureaucracies will deliver, most of which aren't true. And the Republicans will just be like, look, they're full of shit. And then, you know, like, that's the contest of ideas that we're stuck with.
Right.
So what you would need is a third way where it's like, look, it turns out we all want the same things. Mm-hmm. We want decent schools for our kids and a thriving economy full of jobs we actually want, and decent healthcare and low crime and high public safety and, like, you know, a positive environment. Like, again, Democrats and Republicans alike want these things.
Yep.
Just the question is, how can we actually start delivering in a time when the media conversation is not around outcomes? It's around drama, politics, perception, social media, the back and forth of the day. Again, we're 28th in the world on public education, clean drinking water, infant mortality, life expectancy, et cetera, with a down arrow.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought, if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15 year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product. And if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
This is the switch that has to happen. And this mess with the schools is waking up a lot of Dems to the fact that, look, this should not be as ideological as it is. I mean, one thing that Bill Maher just put out that you just sent me was that Democrats dramatically overestimate the chances of COVID putting you in the hospital.
And it's not like, you know, the actual number is 1% to 5%, right?
Yeah.
Some of that. But it's not like we think 20% of the people are dying. It's they think like 50%+ of people are dying. And 70% of the party thinks it's over 20% of people are dying.
Yeah. So this to me has to be the message that these moms are finding out.
Yeah.
Is that the Democrats imagine that they're the party of facts and science, and then the Republicans are troglodytes and, you know, like ignorant and the rest of it.
Yep.
But then when you start digging, it turns out that the Democrats are actually tribal and ideological in the same way as anyone else. And that's not a knock. It's just, you know, everyone's somewhat tribal. But then if someone like this mom in Cleveland raise her hand and be like, hey, I'm a member of the tribe and like, you know, these facts aren't lining up, then they'll just get hammered down. Like instead of, you know, so like because then they'll be like, hey, it turns out you're not on our team or whatnot.
Yes.
And there are all these people embedded within the Democratic Party who actually have similar points of view who fear the hammering down. Yes. They know if they say these things. And that's what we're going to get to now, which is. Your experience as someone who is something of a convert to the Democratic Party, that there is a sense that some people's experiences are more valid than others. If you are, let's say, in your case, like a straight white dude, or in this author's case, like a white mom, then you're not allowed to criticize or talk. And that if you do, then you're going to be personally attacked.
It's a really deep point, and it's this. She's talking about where do you go, right? And the challenge is on the presidential level, which a lot of us, we hold a president, it's a different election, right? We hold them as like almost godlike, essentially, in terms of our leaders and who we look up to and blame things on. And that's, there's a lot of like research on that too. It's a combination of whether it's virtue signaling or the right mouthpiece in terms of who can say what and what can be said. And I'm curious your thoughts on this because my hesitation of ever getting into politics is that I'm a like socially aligned with the Democrats. I think the Democrats generally have the right policies on a lot of things. Some things on the Republican side, I think, you know, I like capitalism more than I do socialism or other things. But I've hesitated because I don't think the Democratic Party loves straight white men. And even when I was talking to you about running before I met you when we first started, I was like, how do you beat Donald Trump? I was like thinking it had to be an outsider. It had to be someone was young. I thought they had to be male because I thought they had to have the balance to the Trump male energy. But I also thought they had to be diverse coming from the Democratic Party to get through that primary. You've talked about this a bit with John McWhorter, but why are Democrats, we're obsessed with identity. I have some thoughts on it too, but we care a lot about the messenger over the message at times. You lived that, I think, both the pros and cons of that.
John described it in his book Woke Racism, which you should check out. You should check out my convo with John if you haven't seen it. He says that there's a certain subset of the Democratic Party that is obsessed with the power differential. So the power differential typically is framed as white-black, where whites have the power, blacks do not. And so whites need to try and address this through various behaviors that John argues don't actually address the fundamental problems that people care about. It's just, you know, sort of a strange behavioral layer. But the other power differentials that people are concerned about are male, female, straight.
Part of the LGBTQ+ community, right?
Yes. And so taking a figure like you, you are all of the quote unquote like positives in the power differentials because you're a straight white male. Also, in your case, you have the sins of being tall, handsome,
Yeah, I'm the devil. I'm the devil incarnate.
The rest of it. So if you frame everything in power differential, then it's like, well, someone like you, then any success you achieve is because you are who you are, and it had nothing to do with your actions, character, work ethic. Like, you know, it's just, you know, you just fell out of bed.
The result, right? Yeah,
And are super successful. And the Asian guy occupies like a nebulous place in this framework, because if you look at Andrew Yang, you think, okay, straight male, Asian, and then you're like, where are Asians in the power differential?
Right.
And the answer is, it is whatever is convenient to you.
They called you the convenient minority behind the scenes. But now we're putting it in front of the scenes if we can. But the Asians are known as a convenient minority in Democratic politics. So they're not a minority when they want some message, and they are people of color when they when it's politically convenient.
Yeah, so I was interested, obviously, as a candidate, how it would be received. And I think that it turns out that that the quote unquote benefits of being a minority did not include me. Like, there wasn't this like, oh, like, you know, look what this person must have overcome as a son of immigrants. Like, yeah, that stuff all went out the window, which I'm more or less cool with. And I think a lot of it, too, is the persona I have, which is I'm not someone who is going to be leading with, like, look at all the shit I've overcome kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, that's not my jam. I'm more like, okay, let's get shit done. You know, let's operate. And one of the major reasons why I wouldn't fall into the negative side of this power differential, the like, less powerful side, is because the perception was like, well, he's a business guy, he's a tech bro, he's a this or that. But to your point in the presidential primary, we've discussed this, there were half a dozen or more straight white men who ran that never got the time of day in the presidential race, many of whom we spoke with personally, you and I, and we liked and thought well of and thought would make fine presidents. One guy who completely got short shrift, Joe Sestak, great guy. Press completely ignored him. People watching this right now are like, who? You can look up Joe Sestak. Michael Bennett, great guy. John Hickenlooper, great guy.
The one
guy
I thought that actually had the full package was John Hickenlooper, where that he was an entrepreneur. He started Goose Island Beer, whatever the beer company is, ran it himself, and then became governor, like has business, political experience, and actually is, like, there were some, and I'm going to leave them nameless, it's not fair, but there were plenty of, where I'm at, like, the world doesn't, we're not clamoring for more straight white dudes in politics. Like, we have that voice, we have that perspective, right? I'm not, that's not the problem.
Well, this to me is one of the dangers.
Go ahead.
Is that if you look at the straight white dudes in politics, the media organizations on the Democratic side do not want to elevate this set of figures.
Yes.
They will accept, like, the folks who are already kind of, you know, emblazoned in the public consciousness, like a Bernie or a Joe.
Right. But why is that, you think? Is it because of representation?
Yeah. There's a fixation on trying to address the power differential. And wouldn't it be great if we got the first X of Y?
Right.
Now, there are a lot of Americans who are kind of impatient with the first X of Y thing, because it doesn't matter as much as we thought or hoped or whatever the hell.
Right.
You know, there were some people that thought Barack Obama, President of the United States, means we're not racist anymore. We're post-racial, which, by the way, we're probably more racist now than we were.
It backfired a bit.
People could, you know, people were making the same argument about Hillary. It's like, hey, first woman president. We, like, show that we would be over it. And then, you know, like, I don't think that would have fixed it. Like that. Imagining
systemic problems, right?
Imagining that having an elected representative of a certain identity. And by the way, like, I'm for people of different backgrounds being in, like, different seats. I mean, I think it's great. Same. But making that, like, the criterion that you're using primarily is not great. And a lot of Americans can sense that the media in particular has gone overboard with this. And one of the byproducts of this is that it has the potential to divide the country further, mm-hmm. where you have, and I'm going to use you as the proxy, you have like reasonable, well-intended white people, men and women, who are generally aligned with the Democratic Party on some things, but feel driven out because there's right. this implicit, like, we don't care about you and your perspective because you are the powerful in the power differential equation, and all we're going to do is talk to people who are from an historically marginalized group.
Because I live this both personally and through you, right, on this campaign. But also, I want to share this with everybody. Like, we live this actually with each other. I don't know if you remember this story. It was really early on. I just started on the campaign. And we'd go into like our first couple meetings, and I'd make these little one-off comments I didn't even realize I was making. I'd be like, we'd talk about your campaign, or I'd talk about the campaign and be like, well, that's if we do okay, or that's before we get a real campaign manager, or we get a real XYZ, or I'd like kind of caveat what we were doing. And you got really mad, and in my opinion, justifiably so. You're like, stop second guessing this, caveating, like, we got to go in guns blazing. We are confident. We're setting the world on fire. This is a vision. We have to get people on board. We can't give them show the cracks in our faith in this, because we don't believe, how are they going to believe? Which is logical. But, and then it got to a point where I was really like proactively working on it, and I was still fucking it up. Like, you would notice it and make you more mad. You're like, I've asked you six times to do this. And I remember I sat you down, probably like, it took me a while to figure out. I'm like, dude, here's the deal. My whole life, I naturally come at it trying to be as humble as humanly possible when I go to a meeting, because I come off as a fucking asshole.
You know, look at this cocky douche.
Look at this shithead. Who's,
where'd he go, Duke?
Straight white man. Yeah, must have gone to Duke. Fuck that, like that, but that's right. And so, like, then you told me, like, and I was like, I think for you, having watching you, like, and this is fucked up too, but like, as an Asian guy, people think you're timid or shy or not sure of yourself and gonna stand there quietly and let people walk over you, which is a bullshit stereotype. So you go the opposite. You're like, bang, extremely. And when you have, if you say the same thing that I would say, it comes off 10 times different. And I've learned that the hard way, because one time in Ohio, I gave your stump speech at like a Democratic event, like the basically word for word stump, awful, crashed and burned, could not do it. The opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian guy who likes math, doesn't sound as cool. It sounds a little offensive coming from me. did not go well. Identity matters. There's systems around us that are creating those perceptions and realities. Did you feel the need to be more confident in yourself and your vision because you were Asian? Or was that something you had growing up too? Or something you felt more in politics? I mean, thoughts on that piece?
Well, certainly on the campaign front, people I knew were going to take their cues from us. And so if I come in and people are like, oh, he's not serious, then, you know, they're not going to tell their friends because they're right. Like, oh, this isn't going to go anywhere. In terms of my upbringing and the rest of it, I was one of the only Asian kids in my public right. school. And so I felt like my masculinity was in question all the time. I'd also skipped a grade. So that made
you're
it
shorter.
I was like scrawnier and shorter and like the rest of it. I had a chip on my shoulder. I got in a lot of fights as a kid. And so then when I lost most of them. And then when I got to like age 17, I started going to the gym.
Yeah.
And so I became like an angry weightlifting Asian guy who drank protein shakes and the rest of it. Yeah, you know those guys.
Yeah.
If you went
spot
to the
me, bro.
Yeah, spot you, bro. And you went if you went to the
Duke, I actually liked them. They played basketball mostly too.
Yes.
Okay.
I did that. And so was that in some ways a response to challenges to my masculinity growing up? 100%.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenon that a lot of Asian guys are familiar with, or if you go to the gym, you see the Asian dudes over there.
It's
pumping iron.
I mean, I'm very, and we could do a whole episode of this. I'm very, very passionate about manhood and understanding. I think some of the biggest problems in our society are caused by weak men, insecure men. Like, if you want to help women, like helping men be less shitty is a really good place to start, frankly, because a lot
yep.
of right? What men go through as kids is. Like, in how they define their masculinity is a big part of that. Right? I did musicals, right? So I had to do sports to balance that out because I like to sing. I like to play saxophone.
You better do some sports then, bro.
I had to, right? And then I didn't fit in either, right? So I've never said this out loud, but I'm curious. It's like, if there's an acceptance in the Democratic Party that the straight white male is the root of all evil and power, like that's the bastion of...
There's a subset of the Democratic Party that would agree
right,
with that statement.
Right, right. That's the problem, right? I don't know if vilifying all of them is the right strategy.
I'm going to say it's the wrong strategy.
Right? So I want to say this, but there's a scene in The Dark Knight Batman when a reporter or it's a lawyer finds out that Bruce Wayne
is like an accountant, a consultant.
Yeah, something like that. And he goes to Morgan Freeman, who's the CEO of Wayne Enterprises. He finds out that they're spending money on the Batmobile and things like that. And the quote is, so he basically says, he tries to blackmail him. He's like, I want $10 million every year for the rest of my life because I'm going to expose this is. And Morgan Freeman looks him in the eye and says, so you think your client, who's one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in the world, is secretly a vigilante who spends his nights beating criminals to a pulp with his bare hands. And your plan is to blackmail this person? Good luck. And that, to me, is what I feel with. Now, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of. I worked with them on Wall Street. There are plenty of white, straight men in power that are doing shitty things or turning a blind eye or proactively keeping people of color and the disadvantaged down. But there are also a good number of folks that fit that same mold that are trying to help. And if you believe that all the power and wealth and energy and whatever the hell is in that one type of person, we'd probably want some of them to be on our team if they want to be. Now, that's not easy. Like someone like me, like I got a lot to learn, right? And I'm...
Well, I would agree with this.
You know?
That you should take people as individuals, in my opinion.
Hmm.
And so if you meet someone and they are a straight white dude thinking like, oh, I will immediately dismiss this person because they can't understand what it means. I mean, the other thing is like people have been through things that you just can't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Like there could be a straight white person whose parents died when he was 3 years old. You know, I mean, like there are different sources of pain beyond just identity based adversity.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it would be ridiculous to think we can build anything but we're going to dismiss people of a certain background,
right?
Like that just doesn't make any sense to me. That and it probably wouldn't be effective. But what you're saying is also true, in that if you want good things to happen, you'd want people who are not just willing friends and parts of the movement, but also people that might have some resources to bring to bear,
yeah,
might have some relationships to bring
some
to bear,
skills,
and the rest of it.
Whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And that's my fear. And I want to ask you about what we think we should do here, because what I'm seeing is, but my, let's call it my white, straight, my male friends, they're drifting away from the Democratic Party. They're aligning up with this woman who wrote the art piece in The Atlantic, or they're shifting closer and closer to the Republican Party. And most of them have always been Democrats and definitely socially liberal and sympathetic and empathetic to the progressive movement their whole life, you know? And I had a group thread about just asking folks, hey, like, basically, how are you feeling about these types of topics? And the quotes I got from my friends or what they feel is that, I'll give you some quotes. I feel like I'm racist. I'm assumed to be a racist as a white person. I feel like I have to speak second always, which, you know, for better or worse, these are not necessarily my quotes, that the meritocracy isn't relevant. So you are, the reason you are successful, any amount of success you've had is because you are white, male, and straight. And a lot of them was, you can't say that. They're afraid of saying anything because, and I am too, and even talking about now, like afraid of stepping on a landmine and saying the wrong thing. And it's hard because if we want, let's call it straight white dudes like myself to help more, you got to let them fuck up a little bit, learn from their mistakes and move on, right? Like, you know, right? As opposed to, oh, you said the wrong thing. You're fucking racist. Go away. You're not part of this movement. And then they either grovel the rest of their life to try and get back in, or they go right to the arms of Trump.
Or what they most likely do is they keep their heads down in various public settings.
Mm, they do nothing. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. They you know, they send their kids to private school and chill.
They don't give a shit.
Yeah.
It's the quote. It's like, the only thing necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. And it's the biggest... In my opinion, this is why I talk to Carly actually, because you get so triggered about stuff on the left and not on the right, when I know you disagree morally with so much stuff on the right. And I think the issue is,
well,
it requires people to do something.
Well, here's my take on it. And people have said the same to me. It's like, you know, not left, not right. It's like you seem to be talking about issues with the Democratic Party more. And it could be because I'm more familiar with them.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is this, where if you have the simple conflict or clash between, hey, we're the establishment, we're the institutions, we know best, and hey, fuck you, burn it down, you're full of shit, then you're looking at it being like, well, my natural impulse then is to go to the people who represent the institutions and be like, okay, like, here's why people are struggling, here's why people are pissed, here's mm-hmm. why they're like
they're losing people.
Yeah, that's like a natural place to be. Mm-hmm. The other place to be over here with these folks, you know, you could urge, I don't know, like patience, like, you know, like, don't Christian, worry, like, they will name? Get their stuff together.
Piccolini? Yeah, like converting white nationalists into, that's harder, you're saying.
But it's not that illogical for you or me to look at, like, these two sides and be like, hey, Institution X, like, maybe you could do this. But part of the issue is that they're not very introspective. And here's one of the reasons why I started the Forward Party is that when you realize that neither victory nor policy is the true focus of either party, mm-hmm. then you get it. Mm-hmm. So the Democratic Party will convey to, and the Republican Party will say, like, hey, we're about, you know, this education policy, like this. And then if you look up and say, okay, like, where are we on these issues? This is why these parents are so pissed off. They're like, wait a minute, I thought you were for this. And it's like, well, you know.
We just wanted to win.
Oh, no. We're for talking about it. But we don't actually want to be held accountable for any results. Right. And then if you try and hold us accountable, then we're like, oh, like, that's not what we're not about. When you realize that they're not about either achieving their goals or even winning races, that's the thing, because you're looking up and you see, like, why did we do things sometimes that are definitely reducing our chances of winning? I mean, because the point is not to win. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to someone and say, hey, Latinx, turns out it pisses off 30% of Latinos and makes 2% of them happy, maybe we should abandon it. Then they'll be like, well, that's not right. And you're like, well, you know, it's just math. I mean, like, if your goal is to win, then you would not use this term. And it'd be like, oh, but, you know,
I can raise money by using the term, or I can keep my job by using the term.
You have a particular, like, ideological bent. Mm. So when you realize that, like, the core is tribal, which, again, these parents found out the hard way, which is, yes, like, hey, like, I thought the goal is help the kids. I'm like, no, kids secondary or tertiary. Or I don't care, because all I want to do is feel good about my team.
To me, like, the Democrats are missing kind of this, like, it's almost like the hierarchy of needs, or like you have the right moral piece, but we're not nailing, we're closing schools, we're missing that. The streets aren't safe, we're missing crime, right? Like, we're not solving healthcare, X, whatever they are, but we've lost.
You need to post institutional wins on the board, and the institutional wins are very, very hard to spot at this point.
Do you think infrastructure bill is something anyone ever touts as something they accomplished?
Oh, there's going to be a lot of, like, crowing about the infrastructure bill, because it's one of the only things they can point to. They're like, you know, by the way, it's going to take months, if not years, to, like, actually see that
roads,
you know, yeah, roads.
And will we actually see roads, you think?
Eventually. I mean, it's like freaking $500 billion plus. So, I mean, it's going to get spent. It's going to get spent.
It's like the new LaGuardia. It'll take 15 years, but then it'll look good.
I love the new LaGuardia.
I love the new LaGuardia. I didn't love how long it took. It took a while.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It is beautiful, though. If you go to LaGuardia, you're going to be like, you'll.
But I want to try and dig into this point you're making about you and your friend group and the rest of it. Like, this is one of the reasons why I've started Forward and why the Forward Party is so important. And I went through this process the same as you did, and we learned a lot and got changed by it. And they're like, you know, the rest of it. We need to be a country where people are not made to feel bad about themselves based upon things they cannot control about their own identity. You know what I mean? Like, that should be the starting point. Now, that's certainly true if you're Black, gay, Latino, like, you know, any marginalized group. Like, you should not be made to feel bad about yourself based upon who you are. Mm-hmm. Also true if you are a tall, handsome, straight, white man, you should not be made to feel bad about yourself based upon.
Like the boohoo straight white guy, get over yourself. Like, you know,
based upon who you are. So the power differential narrative that John and I'm so proud of my sit down with John, because I think it unpacks, because of John's genius. Like, you know, I was just there.
It's probably one of our best best performing episodes for sure, but it's definitely one of our best quality wise.
But that power differential narrative that he framed as white versus black, it's in everything now. It's certainly male, female, straight, gay, rich, poor. Like the rich, poor thing, one of the dynamics that's occurring now is that as soon as like an activist becomes successful and has some money, then everyone turns on him because like, oh, now you're rich.
You use the XYZ funds for your
you
house.
Bought a house? Yeah, like they'll like attack people on that level.
It's like Bernie, but you used to hammer the millionaires and the billionaires, and now he just hammers the billionaires because he's a millionaire.
Yeah.
Which I don't have a problem with Bernie making money on. He's a warrior. He's fighting for the people. Like,
he's written a bunch of books. The dude's 80, 81. I mean, no, he's not that old, is he? He might be that old.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Siri, how old is Bernie Sanders? 80.
Yeah.
Bernie's 80 years old. Yeah.
So for an 80-year-old to have crossed the million-dollar threshold, I mean.
At 80.
Yeah. It's like, I don't think you should really have a huge problem with that. He's not going to then turn around and lose his way at 80. There is certainly truth to the fact that society advantages certain types of people and that there's a lot of unfairness. And you can accept that unfairness without then projecting it onto the character of any individual within the system. You can say, like, look, this system needs improvement. I'd like to help improve it. My, frankly, like most effective direct suggestion would be to put money into people's hands. Yes. I think that would be the most powerful. You know, like if you took the average struggling black person, you said, hey, I'm going to give you a choice. On one hand, give you $1,000. On the other hand, I'm going to get this white dude to apologize to you. Like, which would they choose? They all choose $1,000. Like, I don't give a shit about this. This person's apologizing to me, especially if it's a person I don't know. You can want to improve a system without thinking anything negative about the character of someone within that system, even if they've succeeded within that system. Because that person, and this is one of the biggest damaging like things, and someone will attack me for this, whatever, holding that individual accountable for the system is just way too far a bridge. You know, and that's one of the intellectual weaknesses of wokeness is like you're responsible, you're complicit, you're culpable. It's like that person was born within a society and whatnot, like saying that they're responsible for the society, you know. And again, this is as someone who is very, very aware of the deep inequities. Like I understand just how fundamentally screwed up a lot of this has been. And I do think that as a society, we should be trying to address problems and make things better for people as quickly as possible. But I don't think it's appropriate to point to any individual within any group and say like, hey, this is your fault. Like, you know, this is you. It's like, because that person will look at that and be, and what you're going to do is drive that person away from whatever you're doing as quickly as possible. And if you do that en masse in our country in this time, you're going to be driving away millions, tens of millions of Americans that you're going to need.
It's one of the things I struggle with so much, Andrew, with that if you say the wrong thing or I say the wrong thing, not just on Twitter, in the press, with your peers, with other big personalities, that is taken in a vacuum, ignoring everything else about you that would give that, quote, context. For example, like you, where you come from, son of immigrants, like being an Asian man, people called you a white nationalist, like absolutely, okay. But then like start taking like your small earnings from your first, like your first successful company sale, starting a nonprofit, then running for president on giving people cash. If you take me like starting a, I worked in philanthropy on Wall Street, have run a nonprofit and then worked on a long shot presidential campaign to help eliminate poverty. Those things matter when you say the wrong thing, if I say the wrong fucking phrase, right? And like by any other objective measurement, you're an ally to trying to help the people that we're talking about. You're clearly, objectively, 1,000,000% an ally trying to improve, but that doesn't seem to matter. My question is, can the Dems fix this? I think the Republicans probably either don't give a shit or but can the Democrats fix this, or is literally the only possible solution either UBI, like mindset of abundance, or multiple political parties where we can like not fix the problem, but just like troll each other and change the the political weight.
So this is the greatest hope we have. And it is in a study that came out about the different tribes. And the middle consists of what's called the exhausted majority, where they're like, oh, you know, like, I don't care about any of this stuff. I just want the ideological nonsense to go away. The stuff we're talking about with the obsession with the power differential or whatnot, it applies to approximately 15% of people, which is a minority even within the Democratic Party. They just happen to be the loudest and most conspicuous. The same is true on the other side, where if you look at hardcore Trumpers, and this is one reason why I think characterizing all Republicans as racist is incorrect. You know, all Trump voters as immoral, incorrect. Where you look at the hardcore conservatives, it's a similar number. It's about 15%.
Interesting.
The problem really is that you have a duopoly where the Republican Party has no choice but then be like, I guess I'm voting for this side. And the Democratic Party, it has a different set of issues. You have this corporate establishment lair. You have like an ideological left that is eager to call out people for misstatements and whatnot. They're different sets of issues.
Yeah.
And I will say that to the extent that I'm concerned about any group in this country, it's the far right who believe that violence is justified. To the extent that there's like a real deadly threat, again, it's not symmetrical.
Yeah.
Like the deadly threat is these violent extremist individuals who, by the way, now that group, it's not going to be like an individual org. Unfortunately, it's like this inchoate group of, frankly, millions, maybe even more, like tens of millions of Americans who are sympathetic to this idea, in part because we're being set up for this clash and this duopoly. Christian Piccolini's work around trying to de-radicalize folks in this space is some of the most important. We should be pouring a ton of energy and resources into it. To the extent that we do degenerate into political violence, it will almost certainly originate with this group. It's one reason why you need to try and carve up this duopoly as quickly as possible, because you have this exhausted majority in the middle who then are looking at it and saying like, oh, like I don't really feel represented. And then they just go home and keep their mouth shut. If you had a movement where people like that felt like, okay, this is it. This is my tribe. I can say I'm forward party and a critical mass of people are able to see themselves represented in this. Now the tough part is that the folks who are quietly at home, keeping their heads down, you know, that they're right now reluctant to raise their hand for just about anything politically, because they're, you know, they have lives and families and like, you know, that they see the dynamic that sprung up. If we were to have a genuinely multi-party system, you would have this middle force that would have a ton of energy and weight. In my ideal structure and framework right now, we'd have five political parties.
Yeah.
There'd be the progressives, the moderate Dems, forward party kind of as a fulcrum, moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans like that. And then if you had that, you'd have a much more coherent system and they would call out the excesses. But right now they can't call out the excesses because they see it as an attack on their team.
I love this as a solution because it doesn't actually pretend that our media environment will ever change, in the sense that if a lot of these parties, they're like calling card is just trolling the other team, which is very much what happens all the time. But if you have five of them, they can gang up on each other in a way, you know, of like, oh, if the Republicans do something awful, then the other four or two or three of them can actually start trolling the Republicans.
The swing group
right?
would become the moderate Republicans because the moderate Republicans are like, yo, that stuff's like crazy and out of bounds. And everybody would be like, oh, you know, like that's.
Yeah. You're the ones closer to the fringes would become pretty powerful.
Because they would need that to get. Because
they'd bring them in when they want them, right?
And if they don't agree, then it doesn't
matter. More powerful of a statement. You're like, actually, we disagree. That's where we draw the line. It's one of the things about the Democratic Party and parts of liberalism where I do think you need to draw a line at certain parts of like, okay, we can be pro teachers, but at some point, hey, teacher, you have to go to work in the pandemic because our kids are getting
not dying.
Yeah. But the kids are getting.
Well, I'm saying that because the data is like it's pretty safe for kids to go to school.
But the kids are losing years of development, right?
They are getting stunted.
Right. Like we can believe in being humane at our borders, but we actually should probably draw a line in having a border because we're a country and that's what usually defines a country in many ways.
If you really believed in institutions in that space, you'd be like, the school being open for kids is mission critical and vital, and you know, we have to make that happen no matter what.
And that's not happening. But I do, so this does give me a little insight into the purpose behind the Forward Party too. It's not just this kind of general psyche or general like zeitgeist. It's like, oh, a third party would be good, right? Like, no, it's actually existential in many ways.
It is. In part because if everything degenerates into like, oh, you're attacking my team, then civil war is inevitable.
Right.
And to our earlier point, you do not want to establish teams based upon immutable identities. You don't want to say like, hey, this party is for like this set of
XYZ people that look like XYZ.
That'll kill you.
Oh, man. Okay. On a more positive note, you watching NFL playoffs coming in.
Dude, you're going to Buffalo.
I'm going.
Is this the biggest game in your memory?
I went to the AFC Championship last year. So I guess that's the bigger game that we lost. We're in Kansas City. But this is the first time we've had a home playoff game in Buffalo since like 96.
And you're going to be there?
I'm going to be there. It's going to be 10
home
degrees.
Home playoff game. Do it. True fandom.
Playing the Patriots. So if you're a Patriots fan and listen to this podcast, just don't. Give me some good juju. I need that good vibes. You guys have had your
He
run.
Is going to Buffalo in 8-degree weather to support
that's
his team.
Be awful.
And if they lose, it's going to be a very sad gathering.
I wasn't going to go if it was on Sunday. You know what I'm saying? Because I needed like having like Sunday scaries or like a regular Monday work and that loss would be awful. But it's a Saturday night game. Saturday night primetime, 8:15, I think. So we'll see. I think this is a fun NFL season because no one knows who's going to win.
I don't believe in the Titans as a number one seed. I don't think anyone does, right?
Who knows, man? I mean, you got to give credit's due. They lost their top two receivers and their star running back and still won 12 games. But like Chiefs and the Bills beat themselves, so they're good enough to win Super Bowls if they actually play well. The rest of that AFC, I mean, like the Bengals can beat most anybody too on any given Sunday.
It's an interesting season. Like, you know, you don't have a heavyweight. As I just said, I don't believe in the Titans. So, you know, it's like you
it's at that point.
What about on the other side?
Brady and Rodgers seem to be my standard.
You feel like Green Bay is going to come up through the NFC, right?
Brady's team's all banged up. They've lost a couple key players. And Antonio Brown lost his mind. I don't know.
It doesn't feel like the Buccaneers have it. Maybe it's because they had that bad loss the other week. The Saints, I think. Was it? They lost to someone they should not have lost to.
Oh, God. It wasn't the Jets, was it?
I thought it was the Saints.
It was the Saints.
We're not
a they had a bad
team.
Loss. I agree. But I think I'm pumped because it's an exciting NFL season and the Bills are relevant in the playoffs. We've won back-to-back AFC championships. This is uncharted territory for me as a fan. This is very exciting. And for those of you who are Georgia fans or people who hate Alabama, congratulations this week on your national championship, Georgia. I tweeted, I think this is true. I don't know if your thoughts. I think a University of Georgia, University of Alabama football game is like watching the Patriots Cowboys play in a Super Bowl. In that no one,
You mean it's too dominant?
No one likes the, I don't know. It just feels.
I was deliberating.
Maybe I'm wrong.
I was deliberating on something, and this is just an aside. I really, really did not like the Patriots during the Belichick Brady era, and then Brady leaving for the Bucks. Like now, I find myself being like, "Hey, did I dislike Brady or did I dislike the Patriots?" I still find myself disliking the Patriots, but now I'm like kind of neutral on Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. I really respect the fact he left and won and is still doing his thing.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. And the longevity and the rest of it. Like, you know, it's funny. It's like him leaving the Patriots now has made me like, oh, like, you know, like, because when he was with the Patriots, I was like, oh, I can't stand those guys.
Oh,
like,
yeah. And then Tom Brady wins the Super Bowl, walks around the city kind of drunk in public. It was like pretty, there's some memes on Tom Brady. It was hilarious. Look, I think the Patriots, I mean, the cheating allegations are rough.
Now I realize between the two of them, it turns out I disliked Belichick.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brady now I'm fine with. So go Bills this weekend.
I'm as a Duke basketball fan, I've seen like I finally feel both sides of this equation, right? Like Duke is a very hated basketball team. People hate Coach K. They love to hate him. It's the most hated team in the country.
Buffalo feels like the nice underdog people story.
Love
right?
that. Yeah. Can't hate Buffalo. That's my my charming aspect, my personality, guys. I'm a Bills fan. That's all I got.
It is very charming. Zach had to have something to fall back on.
The devil incarnate asshole of this podcast. You're welcome, America. This was fun, Andrew. This was good. Hopefully we didn't say anything too bad. We'll see you next week, folks.
Bye, everyone.